Well, the thoughts that were in my mind when we were bowing and all this and preparing to give and receive a talk were that I don't know if I have anything really that helpful to say, you know? Would you feel that way, do you think, you know? One wants to be useful and smart and clever and... And of course, oftentimes when Jeff and I have the wonderful opportunity to teach together, our talks somehow magically, without our doing any coordinating, fit together. It doesn't really feel that way with what I plan to say. But then it was nice to be able to remind myself that it's not really about the content, our practice, you know? It's not really about what we're thinking about or what we figured out or what our clever brain believes is going on. It seems to be more about process. The process of practicing together, healing together, living, you know, embodying these ways, this form of practice together. And so then I thought, okay, I'll just do the process. And then they like bring me all these things, and it's so sweet. Of course, also the mind can come up with not feeling deserving of all that, but that's another story. Well, let's continue with the process. Words being spoken and heard, breath being breathed, bodies living on for another 45 minutes, and then the next thing happens. An old woman asked Master Zhao Zhao, "I have a body that contains the five obstacles. How can I be free of the world of suffering? How can I be free with this body?" Zhao Zhao, the teacher Zhao Zhao, replied, "Pray that all beings are born in heaven and that you yourself suffer forever in a sea of hardships." And I was thinking he could also have said, well, you have Buddha's body. What more do you need? So we have these bodies with what we perceive to be obstacles in them, of them. And we want somebody to take the pain away. Maybe for very altruistic reasons, we want to suffer, we want to help others, but we're in this suffering body. How can we be free? So the suggestion for us to investigate these days is that we already have the right body. We already have Buddha's body, the perfect body for us to practice in and with and through. And Rahatsu is a special retreat, as Connie was telling us on the first night. It's a celebration of awakening, a celebration of enlightenment, a celebration of Buddha. Celebration of the awesome power of human beings to be awake, to be loving, to be insightful, to be compassionate. It's a retreat for us to remember that somehow we're on the same path as Buddha. Maybe it's kind of wandered here and there over the centuries, but we're on the same path as Buddha. And we're on this path in this body. And we can feel so oppressed by the body, don't you think? Just like we lately can feel so oppressed by the state of the world, what seem to be such dark times. So can just sitting here and doing all these little rituals, and you may have noticed that the Zen Sesshin, the Sesshin is a lot more going on than just meditation. It seems to be a much more complicated situation than that. There are simpler ways to go about it, you know. But this is what we're doing. This is the path we're following. So can sitting here, doing our best with what we got, trying to embody Buddha, is that really a meaningful response to the world? Well, one of our favorite koans asks us, what do you mean by that? The line in one of our stories that says, what do you call the world? Tell me, what do you call the world? Reminding us that we never really quite know what the world is, do we? The mind sticks to various facts and things we've heard and things we tell ourselves and tell each other, the dramatic problems and disasters. They loom in our hearts, as well they should, right? And the mind doesn't hold on very readily or connect so easily, maybe, to the billions of everyday acts of kindness and compassion that also must be the world. There are certainly some disturbing trends, as David Loy's piece was reminding us, especially if we focus our attention on the ecosystem, very disturbing, very frightening. And disturbing trends in the political eco, whatever that is. I don't know if it's a system. And the mind sees and hears about the dramatic violence, the horrible accidents. But then we also hear that there's actually positive global movement in the average human life. Like pretty tremendous amount of positive movement in the average human life. More people than ever having their basic needs met. Education is better. Healthcare is better. On the whole, they tell us, things are better. And then the mind goes to the latest unexpected action from Donald Trump. It took me a while to figure out unexpected would be a good, you know, adjective. You know. Yeah, it's unexpected what he does, you know. It's true. And my mind goes to the sewage running in the ditches in front of the little ramshackle houses in the Kibera slum in Nairobi. And it's interesting, it's easier for the mind to go to the sewage, looking down, than the people, well-dressed, in clean clothes, going about their lives that day. What do we call the world? And how is this world built in your mind? So our response in our tradition seems to not be so much figuring out, but sitting down. And that Zazen takes care of us in a mysterious way. And we're developing, I think, faith that Zazen's taking care of all of us and beyond all of us in very many ways that we can't quite see or understand, but we can feel. That the response of our Zen ancestors really, really is compassionate, really is deep. So it really feels like there's plenty of good reason to recommit to Zazen as our appropriate response to the world. Interesting, when I say that, I find myself wanting to qualify it, like Zazen is part of the response, you know. Don't sit around all day. Well, what would be wrong with that? And the interesting thing about Zazen is that it's done with the body, done with the whole body. We hear about meditation, we think about the mind, and then we sit down and we're thinking in the mind. But actually, this is a practice of the body. Nothing is left out or excluded for it to be Zazen and not just sitting there fretting. I was thinking we're so lucky to have received this way of practice. I think this is the kind of thing that we can only receive live, you know, even though we are in the supposedly the digital age, right? I don't think that we could have ever have received this practice to the extent that we have, which is maybe only partial so far, but to the extent that we have, that we're confident enough to constellate this three-day retreat and do everything we all had to do. Every one of us had to do so much to be here, so this took a lot of confidence in what we're doing. We've done all kinds of other things. I think we never would have had that confidence if we read about this in the book, or we watched even like the most funny and shareable video ever produced on YouTube. We would have shared it. Yeah. And then read the next 75 posts, you know, we wouldn't be here. I think we would never have the confidence in this way of practice without living examples that we've actually met and practiced with and talked to and hugged and seen apparent benefits and seen the person's foibles and humanity. So I think we're really lucky about lineage, like really lucky. And even though the Zen idea of lineage is a little romanticized, you know, on the whole, you know, back to Buddha and all that. Buddhist scholars have a lot of fun with that, you know. It's like catnip to Buddhist scholars, you know. The unbroken lineage back to Buddha. Oh, God. Good material here. But it's also true. It's also very true. And so we're so supported, maybe most supported by the living lineage of practice. Much as our mind wants to figure this out and wants to know the rules and how to do it and what the benefits are and what would happen to if we put ourselves into the functional magnetic resonance imager and if our brain was any better for all these years of practice. Next year for me it's 30 years of practice. But it's not about all that. Lately I've been so encouraged also by the early teachings of Buddha as best we can understand them through translation and centuries and centuries. One of my favorite Buddhist scholars, who's part of the team, you know, that debunks things like the lineage, is a guy named Donald Lopez, and he says unequivocally, you know, they don't usually say things very unequivocally, scholars, but he says unequivocally, the original words and doings of the Buddha are unrecoverable. So he said unrecoverable, we'll never know. Lost, you know, in the midst of time. But it's a wonderful fiction to have these teachings that we know the Buddha said. So I've been encouraged to return lately to the Mindfulness Sutra, teachings of Buddha on how we apply mindfulness in a way that heals and connects. He says in there that the deep practice of mindfulness and the way that he talks about it is like a one-way street. You can't ever kind of regress, regression-free. You're only going to heal. You're only going to grow in wisdom and compassion if you practice mindfulness. In that sutra, he encourages us to focus on four areas of existence, and the first thing he encourages, as you well know, is the body. Is the body. Mindfulness in the body. He said something like, Here's how the practitioner remains established in mindfulness of the body in the body. Be mindful of the body from the inside, from the outside, and from both the inside and the outside. Be mindful in the observation of the process of coming to be in the body, coming to be in the body, and the process of dissolution in the body, and both coming to be and dissolution. It's translated as process singular, but of course it's massively plural, right? Gazillion processes coming and going. As my favorite party says, be deeply mindful of the fact there is a body here. Exploring the knowing that there is a body here until understanding and full awareness come about. It's the great thing about simple teachings. You try to put them into action and you realize they're not so simple. Of course I know there's a body here. But look at your actual, behavior, and your actual way that you think. And you may not be able to quite convince yourself that you know that there's a body here sometimes. We get so disconnected, don't we? And then he goes on to encourage us to be mindful of the body in every position that it takes. And he lists them off, standing, sitting, walking, and so on. And to be completely inclusive in that. He specifically mentions going to the toilet, so don't treat that like a break from Kinhin. That's like your meditation practice. You go to the bathroom. And I always forget and then remember, because of course we can't hold these things in our mind very well. I forget and I remember when we get in the middle of these retreats, what a great opportunity this is to practice this mindfulness of the body. So many of our distractions are stripped away. We're put into a certain kind of situation. Sometimes we say a container, Put us all in the container and seal up the lid real good for 3 days and see what you get at the end. So there's an opportunity here through practice with the body for a kind of continuity in practice. That, of course, is how it always is. It's how life actually is. But we segment, right? And we break up and we discontinuify things, if that's a word. We get so fragmented. And it's a little bit of a product of our language. We can't help it. We say things as if they meant something like, that's the end of Zazen. We say that, right? Ding, that's the end of Zazen. As if that was like a true statement that made sense. So to recognize experientially in our body that, well, there may have been some hearing of some signal and now the body's in a different position, but there's no ending of Zazen and there's no beginning of Zazen. And the Buddha in this teaching encourages us to really contemplate the dynamic and impermanent nature of the body mirroring the rest of the universe. He lists off in the sort of language of his time the systems and organs and elements of the body. Encourages us to contemplate their function and their nature. And there's some kind of cute stuff in there to help us not be so vain about the body. I guess maybe the household that the Buddha grew up in, they were like really pretty people and they spent a lot of time grooming or something, because he encouraged us to contemplate how disgusting the body is actually. Which I think maybe in our cultural time is not as helpful. We already know how disgusting the body is. That's why we buy so many products, We know what to do. We buy stuff. So maybe for us it's to contemplate the interpenetration and complexity and unknowability of the body. There are actually a few people among us who survived the Western hazing ritual of medical school. Congratulations to survivors of that. And I bet if we asked them, they would say, well, I don't understand the body, you know. All those years of hardcore education, just the beginning of understanding the body. And of course, we know there's more inside this sack of skin than just like the organs that we can list off, too. Organs and proteins and hormones and nervous system, all that. Even beyond all that, all the cells that are supposedly us, you know, generated from our genetic material. There are also, I'm told, approximately 10 billion bacteria inside the skin sac here. That's billion with a B. So we could ask the same question of ourselves as that we ask of the world. What do you call the body? What is this body anyway? It's a giant host, apparently, for all these other creatures. Maybe we'd take care of ourselves better if we really loved the bacteria in our body a little more. Like, oh, you nice bacteria, I'm going to give you really good food today. No junk food, that would be so rude, you know. And then once we get our mind around how complicated and interpenetrated and changing it is, we can feel more fully how temporary it is. This body, all the bodies, the body of the world. The Buddha used to send the monks off to the graveyards to contemplate decomposing bodies to help them get that. At least that's what the text suggests. And that's a good practice actually now, even though the bodies are like covered up for us for the most part. It's good actually to go practice walking meditation at the cemeteries. It's a good practice to do. Just remember how brief this is. But none of this is easy. In these early Buddhist texts, he's really good at telling us kind of, you know, here's how it is, but not so good usually about telling us, well, what do you do about that? Maybe he cleverly leaves that up to us to find our way. So it's not so easy to practice with this body, is it? The body can be really disturbing, really painful. Often we just want the body to leave us alone, don't we? We would like it to be functioning normally, pain-free, so we can do what we want to do. Well, who do we think we are if we are not the body, so that the body should leave us alone so that we can do what we want to do? Who is that one? It does seem like the way forward is only through deeply connecting with the body, including our pain, including our aversions, including our discomforts. As the unnamed woman in the story said, this body full of hindrances. The teacher says it's perfect. It's the right one. You got the one you need for this bodhisattva way. Including with the pains, with the weird little things that happen. I have an unexplained little growth on my foot. What? Never had that before. Maybe aging gives us these nice little new lessons in the body. I almost jammed my foot in front of poor Ken here in Dokusan. I was really tempted. It was about his practice, not about my foot, so I kept it under there, you know. But later, I might. Anyway. The body feels so limited, doesn't it, you know? If only it was not so difficult to be in the body. But then, if we think about it, to say the body is limited, or the body is painful, or the body is anything we could say, This is always in comparison or in reference to some idea of a different body, isn't it? Maybe some quality of my body feels limited or painful or not okay compared to other bodies that I see around me, at least what I infer the other bodies to be like. Or maybe compared to some memory I have of a previous body of mine. Of course, memory's a little doubtful. But the thing is, this is the one we have now, which is the only one we have, which is the only one we'll ever have. So can we fully inhabit the body, allowing the body, loving the body, connecting to the body, being in the body? And this can be hard. The body can be a tough teacher. And we want to turn away when it's painful. We have a lot of support. Each other, our wide heart, our teachers, our ancestors. A lot of support to allow ourselves to release that fear and enter more fully into the body. To breathe the body of pain and the body of joy, the body of warmth, the body of movement, the body of tension, the body of confusion, to let that body breathe us and carry us. And we don't have to manipulate the body or improve the body or force the body to do something or be something it is not. But probably, we do really need to show up in the body. Let ourselves enter it more fully, see it as a Dharma gate that's ready to open whenever we're ready to enter. To study the sensations and experiences of the body with curiosity, with kindness, with as much openness as we can muster. And in the end, this may really help us anyway. Maybe we can learn to be a little more comfortable in our discomfort and equanimous in our pain. And this only happens now, right now. Breathing with the body, being in the body. The tricky thing about all this is that our practice is actually not a self-conscious thing. You hear these teachings and you think, oh, good instructions, what I wanted. So it's kind of a problem with giving these talks and some of the things we say to ourselves and say to each other. We might think that there are some tips and tricks that if only I learned them, everything would be better. Is there some way for me, and where do I think I am exactly? Maybe like a little guy up here in the control room or something, me up here. There's a great movie by Eddie Murphy about this you have to see. I forget the name of it. Anyway, if this little me up here could just learn the right way, you know, the right levers to pull. Eddie Murphy's actually an alien, like a tiny little alien, about this big. And his disguise is a human body. I forget if it's like a robot body or they took over a body or something, but it looks like a human body. But he's actually up in this little control room pulling levers. It's very good. Kind of like that Disney cartoon about emotions, but it's better than that. Anyway. We got to use our mind. It's what we got, but it's not all we got. The beauty of Zazen is this encouragement to settle that down. to trust in the organic, felt, mysterious nature of all this. That it's really not about figuring it out or doing it right, applying the right technique. Could be taken that way. Oh, here's the deal. That's how it works. If I do it this way, everything will be better. I'll feel better. Our first concern, right? And then, oh, bonus, I'll be able to help other people too. Good. Right. I quoted Suzuki Roshi a little bit last night, and I was just reflecting on what great ways he had about talking about this sort of immersive, not me flavor of our practice. Last night I read you a quote that's on our little Sangha brochure. He said, "Our way is to practice one step at a time, one breath at a time, with no gaining idea, with no gaining idea." Right away, the mind that does gaining ideas is pretty quick to point out a problem here, right? Like, what's the point of that? Right? So somehow he gently just kept at it, trying to find different ways to talk about this. And I've wondered a lot about the cultural moment of 1958, 59, when the Zen Center was starting in San Francisco, and why didn't anybody show up and listen to this little Japanese guy saying, "I've got this wonderful, difficult practice that doesn't get you anything. So you should just forget about getting anything out of this, and it'll be great." And I think it must be because they could feel the embodiment of the practice, that they could see with their eyes and hear with their ears and smell with their nose and touch with their fingertips. A living example of practice. So let's hear a little bit more from Suzuki Roshi. That'll be good for us. This is from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which we always point out when we crack it open. Somehow we always have to point this out. I don't know if it's a pride thing in the lineage, but this is the best-selling English-language book on Buddhism and history. Been in print for longer than any book besides the Bible, I think. Maybe there's others. So it's really good. You know. People are buying the book. You don't know what they're doing with it. Maybe we have one on the shelf at home, too. So those of you who are not a fan of words in the Zendo will appreciate how he begins this little talk. He says, "I do not feel like speaking after Zazen. I feel the practice of Zazen is enough. But if I must say something, I think I would like to talk about how wonderful it is to practice Zazen. Our purpose is just to keep this practice forever. This practice started from beginningless time, and it will continue into the endless future. Strictly speaking, for a human being, there is no other practice than this practice. There is no other way of life than this way of life. Zen practice is the direct expression of our true nature." Of course, whatever we do is an expression of our true nature. But without this practice, it's difficult to realize. That's a really important line, I think. Of course, whatever we do is an expression of our true nature, right? There's no special other thing called true nature that we're going to get from the Zen retreat. Everything we do is an expression of our true nature. But without this practice, it's difficult to realize that. It is our human nature to be active, and it's the nature of every existence. As long as we are alive, we are always doing something. But as long as you think, "I am doing this," or "I have to do this," or "I must attain something special," you're actually not doing anything when you give up. When you no longer want something, or when you do not try to do anything special, that is when you do something. When there is no gaining idea in what you do, then you do something. In Zazen, what you're doing is not for the sake of anything. You may feel as if you were doing something special, but actually it is only the expression of your true nature. It is the activity which appeases your innermost desire. But as long as you think you are practicing Zazen for the sake of something, that's not true practice. So that turns out to be the motivator. This is the activity that appeases our inmost desire. What is our inmost desire? That'd be a great practice question. What is my inmost desire? There's surfacey things. Those are pretty quick to recognize, right? Desires. What is my inmost desire? When we express our true nature in this way, then we're human beings. Then we're human beings. When we do not, I don't know what we are. We're not an animal because we walk on two legs. We're something different from an animal, but what are we? We may be a ghost. We do not know what to call ourselves. Such a creature does not actually exist. It's a delusion. We are not a human being anymore. We just exist. When Zen is Zen, nothing exists. Intellectually, my talk makes no sense. But if you have experienced true practice, you'll understand what I mean. If something exists, it has its true nature, its Buddha nature. So we practice to be human beings, so that we actually exist. In the Parinirvana Sutra, Buddha says, everything has Buddha nature. Everything has Buddha nature. Inclusive vision, right? There's no devil, exactly. Everything has Buddha nature. Suzuki Roshi goes on to say, but Dogen reads it a little differently. He reads it this way. Everything is Buddha nature. Everything is Buddha nature. There is a difference. If you say everything has Buddha nature, it means Buddha nature is in each existence. So Buddha nature and each existence are different. Two different things. But when you say everything is Buddha nature, it means everything is Buddha nature itself. When there is no Buddha nature, there is nothing at all. Something apart from Buddha nature is just a delusion. It may exist in your mind, but such things actually do not exist. When you continue this practice week after week, year after year, your experience will become deeper and deeper. And your experience will cover everything you do in your everyday life. Cover like include. The most important thing is to forget all gaining ideas, all dualistic ideas. In other words, just practice Zazen. Hold the posture. Do not think about anything. Just remain on your cushion without expecting anything. Then eventually you will resume your true nature. That is to say, your true nature resumes itself. I think he kind of caught himself there, trying to say all this in English. Eventually you resume your own true nature as if there's you and your true nature and you're going to find it. Then he catches himself at the end. That is to say, your true nature resumes itself. So it's worth taking up Suzuki Roshi, I think, from time to time. All this makes me think of the koan that Norman asked us to end our Shuso dialogue ceremonies with our Shuso training ceremonies. We have one coming up, so it's a little bit on my mind in March. Usually in that ceremony where the head student is expressing their understanding, responding to the Sangha, they've contemplated a koan. And in some schools, it's different koans depending on what's going on. And Norman suggested, no, this is the koan. We need to just keep setting this koan. So here's the koan. It's called Nanchuan's Everyday Mind is the Way. And it features the same teacher as the body story from the beginning. Jiaozhou. It's Jiaozhou, but a little earlier in his career, when he's a young monk, talking to his teacher. Jiaozhou and his teacher is called Nanchuan. Jiaozhou asked Nanchuan, "What is the way?" Nanchuan said, "Everyday mind is the way." Jiaozhou said, "How should I direct myself towards it?" Nanchuan replied, "If you direct yourself towards it, you'll be going in the wrong direction." Nanchuan replied, "Well, if you direct yourself," Jiaozhou said, "Well, but if you don't direct myself towards it, if I don't direct myself towards it, how can I know it?" Nanchuan said, "The way has nothing to do with knowing and not knowing. Knowing is an exaggeration. Not knowing is stupidity. When you enter the way, you see it as vast and boundless as space. What has this to do with yes and no thinking?" Jiaozhou suddenly understood Nanchuan's meaning for himself. It's kind of a standard tagline. Like he got it. So how do we practice? What is the way? Everyday mind is the way. Okay. Yeah. That seems like my usual insanity. That's not, can't be that, you know. But he's a good student. He doesn't say, "Oh, that sounds terrible." He says, "Okay, well, it must be some other kind of everyday mind that I don't understand, so how do I practice that? What's the instruction? How do I direct myself towards it?" Teacher said, "That's the wrong question." That's the wrong question. If you direct yourself towards it, you're going already the wrong way, wrong direction. Okay, well, if I can't direct myself towards it, you know, then what? How can I know this? So this is really our question in Sesshin, isn't it? And in life, can we free ourselves from this tension, this endless strain of trying to do it right, of knowing, of not knowing? Can we release ourselves from our exaggerated ways, our prideful arrogance, thinking I know who I am, who you are, what needs to happen, who they should vote for, and so on and so forth? Surely that's an exaggeration based on partial information. But nor can we just park it. Oh, I don't know. Stupid. It's just stupid. But maybe we can feel some resonance or some sense at the edge of our mind, in our pores, in our DNA, in our feet. Some connection with the vastness and the boundlessness of our life. How far beyond that must be from anything that we could say or think about or figure out. And then we too we'll realize Nanchuan's meaning for ourselves. And maybe we already have. Maybe we already have. And maybe we'll feel it in the body. So, thanks for listening to my talk and Jeff's talks, and generally inviting us to take whatever this role is. And of course, the great thing about our Zen retreat is, especially like, you know, it's funny, like, if you're in, one day you'll be in the organizing committee of one of these retreats, and I'll tell you what you're going to hear. Special preview. You say, oh no, there's not enough people, there's so many jobs to do, it's so complicated, But we'll figure it out, you know, usually we're hard, I'm like, we'll figure it out. And in the end, everyone has a crucial role, right? Every single person has a crucial role in the whole retreat. It doesn't matter if there's 10 people or 70, you know, every person has a crucial role. The teacher being one of them, you know, the bell ringer being one of them, the registrar and so on and so forth, the cooks, and everyone has a crucial role. And that becomes an essential part of what we're doing too. Or maybe that was the essential part all along. It's just continuing this way forward together, reenacting this complicated ritual together. Some roles seem to be more visible, but they're all equally essential. So all that said, thank you for taking your role, and thank you for supporting Jeff and I to take the roles that karma laid on us, you know. How'd that happen? Karma could have made a better choice. But it's not us, not for us to say. Tonight we'll have an interesting ritual, the ritual of night sitting. One of the great things about the Zen retreat is the structure and power of the schedule keeps us going, but it's also really important and valuable to practice without a schedule, so that's tonight's practice, is schedule-less. Everyone's invited to sit as much or as little as the body and mind can try to figure out, you know. Maybe don't believe your first impulse, but trust your gut. If your first impulse is, yeah, I'm all in, I'm hardcore, I'm sitting all night, maybe question that a little bit. If your first impulse is, are you crazy? That's like the worst thing ever, man. I'm out of here the minute the bell rings, if not before. And maybe question that a little bit. Maybe the mind and body could play with it, you know, could play with it a little bit. And it's a commemorative sit, you know, the storyline, as you probably know, is the Buddha taking his seat beneath the Bodhi tree all night or for 7 nights or for 7 years, depending on the mythology that you like, with a lot of determination and a lot of love to wake up for the sake of the world. So that's tonight's adventure. And you can, you know, sit a while and go snooze for a while. Sometimes, even if I'm not sleeping at the Dharma Hall, I'll bring my sleeping bag and go find some corner, you know, to go snooze for a while. And then maybe a dream will inspire me to get up and put the body in a sitting position, you know. And then maybe I'm not sure the next morning, did I dream that, you know? So it's good to be... play a little bit with what the Western anthropologists were trying to figure out, you know, non-Western people, and they came up with this idea of a liminal state. So it's a time to play in the liminal state, the state in between waking and sleeping and knowing and not knowing. And then tomorrow we'll celebrate with an extra ceremony, very joyful ceremony, in which flowers will magically appear in the room. Maybe you heard about those already. And then we'll get to eat breakfast and chat and hang out and be bodies in a new configuration. So, enough for now. Thanks a lot.